So let's start with one of the fun things about the Buddhist traditions that I know a little bit about is they can have prayers that last weeks, months, years, like the Jesus prayer, a lifetime, many lifetimes, or they also have kind of laptop, portable, short prayers. So I think we'll do the latter. Yeah, we don't have time for a lifetime prayer today. It's very short. It comes from the Metta Sutta, that is to say, the Discourse on Loving Kindness. And this is something that some of you were, perhaps you met His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Most of the great Buddhist teachers, when they're not doing philosophy with students, they are saying always compassion, loving kindness. In the Buddhist traditions, they make a distinction, and I'll just give this, in terms of prayer, between what is translated as compassion on the one hand and loving kindness. Of course, its ultimate goal and end is the same, to open our hearts to each other, to surrender our fallible nature in the presence of others. But the term compassion, karuna, means prayer that takes as its object mindful attunement to the realm of suffering and pain. So compassion practices are practices that orient and have as their object detecting and sustaining and not turning away from pain and suffering. And some people have chosen this as their lifetime practice. And there are many, many varieties. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is considered by those in his tradition to be the living presence of enlightened compassion. That is to say that his constant presence is continually attuned to creaturely pain and suffering. The sound associated with enlightened compassion is somehow very well known in the West. It is a mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Many people have heard this. One of my teachers carved these words, Om Mani Padme Hum, as if spirit is now incarnate in earthly matter. And he has asked me to bring it just as a gesture of his presence when I go someplace and share things that matter. This is a bit in the background. I'll have more to say about that later and in later times. The other practice, loving kindness, does not take suffering as its object. That's compassion. These words get confused in English. Loving kindness, or metta or maitri, takes as its object happiness. It's a practice of locating and sustaining mindful awareness of happiness and causes of happiness. So compassion is mindful identification and sustaining awareness in the realm of suffering and pain, and loving kindness is mindful awareness sustaining connection with happiness and sources of happiness. So we will do a loving kindness meditation. I say we will do whatever we want. I will give a very short practice. And it's very, very short. And the advantage is it can be done quickly. It can be done repeatedly. We leave the variations in each way that makes sense to us. And I will tell you what the evocation is, which is in English, and then how we might work with it, and then we'll just do it. It's very simple. Repetition, japa in Sanskrit. Repetition for fickle attention deficit beings. Repetition, remembrance of things that are important is said to be a benefit in the spiritual traditions that have come out of India. And so we will repeat one phrase twice, then pause and see what arises for us as a kind of opening. Just see how we are with that. And then we'll repeat another phrase twice and see what arises from that. The first phrase in each of these is, in a way, an invocation. It starts with the word may I. So the first phrase is, may I be happy. And it's repeated, may I be happy, may I be happy. And no shoulds here, just may I be happy. It's very open. Then we pause, we see what arises for us. And the second phrase is, may all living beings be happy. May all living beings be happy. And then we pause there and we just see what arises. Very quick. Yeah? Simple. Seemingly. Yeah. So this is from the Metta Sutra, spoken by the historical Buddha, from the Sutta on Loving Kindness. And this is a very short version. It could become very elaborate. Yeah? It's okay? So if you're settled, sometimes you shift your body posture, sometimes you don't. It's good to breathe beforehand. Wake up, go to sleep. Yeah. This is a practice that's done daily on this planet by hundreds and thousands, millions of people. And it's said that this evocation actually sets up a vibrational field that is a good. It's helpful. So maybe here it's helpful. May I be happy. May I be happy. May all living creatures be happy. May all living creatures be happy. Sarvamangalam. In the oral traditions, it's said that this is a practice that if one is so moved, you can do kind of in a formal setting like this, by yourself. As you're walking in the bazaar, in the souk, wherever you go, yeah. See, I lowered my voice. Alas, Alon is right. The only trick about practices, however, is they're generally only effective, it says, if you remember to do them. I thought I might say something about what it is that what we will call for the purposes of this gathering saintly Buddhist individuals embody. So today's talk will be to sort of establish a feeling. This is not a yeshiva. We'll try to establish a feeling for what the realm, the being, the dynamics, the flow, the energy that is associated with what it is that saints embody might seem like. Mm-hmm. I could have said, but it would have been far too pedestrian, what's a Buddha? How would we know? Who cares? So instead, I use this term, enlightened energy. It's the same thing. I wanted to start by saying just a few words about the historical exemplar known as the Buddha, even though the word Buddha doesn't mean an individual, but rather a dynamic state that befell a certain creature who, to the end of his day, said, I am a human being. And because I think that words are the carriers of vision, I wanted, with your indulgence, to use the words Sanskrit, Samskrita, but I will not put it in Devanagari. To use the words that were used and are used to echo the tradition. And we start with, historically, the life of the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, 500 BCE-ish. The ish means plus or minus, no? There are volumes and conferences on the date of the Buddha. The Nepalese and the Indians are arguing about which side of the border of current sovereign states the Buddha was born. Not our purpose here today. I wanted to use as my starting point the given name that in a way was a clue about this person, Siddhartha, because in a way, if we know something about the resonances of the two aspects of his name, already we have the whole show. Parenthetically, it's said in the living traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, to the superior student, this is like the yeshiva, all they have to do is hear the title of the text, and immediately they know everything that was in it. For those of lesser intelligence, they have to hear an oral reading, or they have to read the text. For the lowest, they have to hear explanations of the text. So, Siddhartha Gautama, Siddha means, arguably, manifestation, presence, realization, something seemingly tangible, present, you can relate to it, Siddha. Something has been realized or manifest, brought about. But what? Artha. Now, artha has a wonderful history in non-Buddhist circles in India. Here I just use it in its sort of core semantic resonance. In my version of artha, we say, artha means at least three seemingly separate but connected things in its semantic core. Artha is what is worthwhile. Worth. One sense of worth is wealth. A tangible sense of worth, like money or wealth or commodities. Yeah? So this is one sense in the name Siddhartha. Another sense is meaning. Interesting, same word. One might say that meaning is the name given to that which orients us towards that which is worthwhile. And there is a distinction in this tradition, as many others, between the meaning and the letter. It's all saying, attend to the meaning. Okay? So you see a connection between what is worthwhile, what is meaningful, and then a third strata of this word is what is of benefit. As if to say, what is meaningful is what is of benefit. And what is of benefit and what is meaningful are evocations of that which orients us towards what is worthwhile. If we hear this and reflect on this deeply, this is nothing's missing. So then Siddhartha is the living presence of artha, of what is meaningful, of what is worthwhile, and what is of benefit. What's in a name? So the common name for one who would later be referred to as Buddha was Siddhartha. The realization or tangible presence of what is beneficial, what is meaningful, what is worthwhile. When this pattern of being that went by the name Siddhartha, as the stories tell us, underwent a radical transformation, that process and the subsequent flow that came as an afterglow from that process was referred to by another word, Buddha. Buddha, to translate it, means having awakened. Having awakened. There's a related term, bodhi, means awakening. It's very interesting. In French, when they translate, they say éveillé, awakening. For some reason, in both German and English, they say enlightened. There's some kind of Aufklärung, some sort of light. But there's no Lichtung, there's no light, there's no word of light in any of this. As a word. So the word Buddha was a word that got applied to this pattern of unfoldment that was formerly known as Siddhartha. Are you all with me so far? Okay? All right. It's said in brief outline that this pattern that goes by the name Siddhartha and then Buddha was born in the Kshatriyan clan, warrior means carrying arms, an evocation of the other days, yes? Guarding the realm, not slaying as your swadharma, but protecting. You might say nurturing, that's the kindler, gentler form of protecting, yeah? Guarding and protecting, protecting and nurturing. Yeah, good question. Yeah, the realm. Yeah, the realm, your community. Yeah, you know, Polizei. How many of you saw the film Little Buddha? Yeah, you saw? Yeah, okay, so now you know the true story, right? You saw it. That was a documentary, no? Yeah. In the life story of the Buddha, just very briefly, before I proceed, just satisfy my curiosity. How many of you have read or at least slept through a course in Buddhism? And I'm not going to ask which was which. Yeah. How many of you, for you, Buddhism anything is something like from Mars. I mean, you just, it still is for me, so I'm raising my hand. Yeah? No? It's sort of a little bit unknown, no? Okay. Yeah, good, okay. It's for him, yeah. The Buddha had a normal, Siddhartha Gautama had a seemingly ordinary life, special ordinary life, it seems that his father, due to the prediction of an astrologer, said, you know, he might be a great world leader or this other kind of yogi denying the world, etc. And like all good fathers, he was very concerned that his son go into the company business. You know, his father was a, they say king, maybe that's a bit much. He was a ruler of a certain area. And the idea of turning away from the world was not something appetizing to the father. We want you to become a lawyer, MBA, don't go to yeshiva, you know. Not that this sounds familiar to anyone. So he tried to protect him. Now, this is the pious myth as it comes down. If there's a problem, a little theology point here, the synoptic gospel problem, there's sort of a gap of 30 years or whatever. It was over 100 years before we start collecting anything about Buddha, so who knows? So I'm telling you the story as it's handed down. We're missing more than 18 minutes of tape here. There's something missing, yeah? It said that in spite of the restrictions on the life, the protective father couldn't shield the Buddha to be, and that there were four moments that shocked him out of the safe surround that was the intention of his father. And these set him on, this set his spiritual crisis, and this set him on his way. And the four, as they're told, are that he went outside the protection of the wall of his family, and he encountered an individual who was not hale and hearty. This individual, he asked, he said to his charioteer, they didn't have, this was what would be like your chauffeur, yeah, they had horses then, what is wrong with this person? And he said, he is sick. I mean, this is a story. It's like he never saw sickness. He said, well, did this individual do something wrong? Why is this individual sick? And the charioteer had to tell him, Siddhartha, all beings who are born, all creatures who are born, will have the pain and suffering of sickness. It's not an accident. It's not some punishment. It's in the nature of having been born at all. He went home. He thought about this silently. He was troubled. He went out again. He encountered another individual who was stooped over, had white hair, told bad jokes. Yeah. He said, what's the problem with this person? Is he sick? No, he's not sick. He's suffering from what we call aging. Aging. Why? All beings who are born age. Then he thought about this, made him uncomfortable. He went out a third time and he saw seemingly a person there. They weren't moving around too much. And he said, is this person sick? No. Is this person aged? Yeah. Is he really old? No. What is the matter with this person? You need something? I'll loan. Okay. He said, well, this is very mysterious. It's called death. What is death? They are no more to breathe. They will not talk, etc., etc., etc. Why did this happen to this person? Alas, all beings who are born will die. He was very troubled by this. He went out a fourth time, and upon that occasion, he saw what they call a seer or a mendicant, some individual walking mindfully with a slight smile. They seemed very calm. They seemed very confident. They seemed very relaxed. The Buddha-to-be had never seen such a one with this confidence, this relaxation, this smile. So he said, what's the matter with this person? Oh, he's happy. He's content. He is leading a holy life. Well, doesn't he know about sickness? Oh, yes, he knows about sickness. Doesn't he know about old age? Yes, he knows about old age. Then he must not know about death. Au contraire. He does know very much about death. So the Buddha posed the following question to himself. What is the nature of being human that we can know that all beings who are born will get sick, will age, and will die, and yet life is worth living in a kind of calm, confident, if not to say jaunty, way? How is that possible? What is, and this in a way bothered him more than the first three. And so, not knowing the answer, he decided he had to find out. This was his, he was 29 years old, and he abandoned the worldly life that his father had carefully tried to protect him from, and he went as a sannyasin, a wandering ascetic, contacting the best and the brightest, the greatest yogis and mystical practitioners and adepts from all around at that time. And parenthetically, our knowledge as scholars of religion about the early practices of yoga, some of the earliest accounts are those retold or encapsulated in Buddhist accounts of the Buddha to be's apprenticeship with the various spiritual traditions in India. So on a historical note, it's very interesting. We have the names of the individuals, we have the names of the practices that he learned. There were six great teachers that he had. He learned what he could learn at the feet of every great master and said, I must go on because I still have questions. After 6 years, at the age of 35, he sat down by a tree known as the Pipal tree. Its genus and species is Ficus religiosus. My thought was, how did he know? Good planning. Yeah? Yeah. And later it was known as the Bodhi tree. Yeah. Because an awakening occurred, not as an event, but as a process, in some of the greatest literature. Ashvaghosha is a great, great poet. Classical Sanskrit in his Buddhacharita tells the incredible dramatic, it makes Wagner seem like, I don't know, Barry Manilow. Incredible, incredible. And it's been a source of literature and plays, etc., etc., etc. The dramatic events that we've come to know as the awakening or the enlightening of the one who had been known as Siddhartha Gautama. From that moment on, at the age of 34, after a process of several weeks in which he penetrated to the great mystical heights and depths, and as a final gesture, with the gesture of touching the earth, imaged as like Gaia these days, a goddess with Bhumi Sparsha, earth touching mudra. He said, as earth is my witness, I have truly overcome all contradiction, fear, paranoia, and penetrated to the riddle of being. Now I'm awakened. The various angels and celestial musicians rejoiced, and they said, this is fantastic. You must go forth, go ye forth, and teach. And he said, alas, I can't. And there was this one sprite, Brahma Sahambati. He said, please, you must manifest for the benefit of others, as if echoing his name. And the Buddha now, he's enlightened. He said something very strange. He said, ah, but the dharma. Dharma means, etymologically, that which upholds or maintains that which is real. That which upholds or maintains that which is real. reality. And the flow that comes from that is so deep and mysterious and paradoxical and difficult to understand that if I were to teach about Dharma and beings would not understand, as it says in the sort of Victorian language of the Polytech Society, if I were to teach and they would not understand, I would be sorely vexed. I would be very, very unhappy. So better I don't teach. And then Brahma Sahampati, this sort of sprite, said, but Lord, surely you remember when you in a previous life were Buddha thus and such, you also, just like now, had your moment of hesitation and yet went forth and taught. Whereupon the Lord Buddha reflected and said, verily it is so, you are right, this was true. And so, as the pattern of before, I must go forth and teach. So from the age of 35 till 80 or 82 years old, 40 plus years, he went all over. And the very first place that he taught was at Sarnath. They say he gave a sermon. Well, I think this is a Protestant way of saying what he did. I imagine there was a pulpit there in Sarnath. Maybe not. So he gave a talk. And this talk has then served as a frame. It's said to be the earliest sharing with those who had gathered about this improbable, difficult to understand truth that he'd come to. It was a response. I never used the word answer. It was a response to the question, if all living creatures are going to endure sickness and old age and death, how is it possible that one can go with full knowledge of this serenely in the world, being kind to each other? And so in a way, Dharma, or in the Buddhist traditions, the Sadharma, the reliable teachings, were said to be a response to this. And what did he say in brief? He said, he made four, it's called Arya Satyas, unusual insights into reality. Sometimes translated noble truths. I think this is not such a helpful. Arya means unusual, very unusual, not obvious. Satya, you maybe know from Gandhi, Satyagraha. Satya, truth and reality are the same word in the Sanskrit word. Satya, truth, satya, reality, comes from the root as, which means to be or exist. Truth is that which is in conformance with what is real. So there isn't this difference. Yeah? So he shared unusual talk about what was real. And his first generalization was that human beings, as a predominant mode of their experience, have incredible dissatisfaction. And the word that he used was dukkha, oftentimes translated as suffering. But there is a key within this word that is very valuable. Ka means space or abode or realm. And du means confined. It's cognate to the Greek dis, you know? Mean not working well. So dukkha is a confined or some kind of space that is wrong, that is not working right. Secondarily, making uncomfortable. Dukkha. He said that this confined, this limited sense of spaciousness is a predominant mode for living creatures, not an exception. This is the first thing he said. The second thing he said was that this pattern of dissatisfaction or confinement is not random, nor is it capricious, that there is a pattern and a cause to this dissatisfaction. And it said that the root cause or pattern of confined space is, he used a kind of technical term, Trishna. I call it Krishna with a T, yeah? And Trishna means literally thirst. Now, I always say to students of religion, take metaphors very literally and seriously, and then you can see something nice. Thirst means you are so dehydrated that your sole preoccupation is finding water. Secondarily, thirst means a craving, a kind of obsessional, habitual, addictive craving. So, he said that what sustains dukkha, confinement, dis-ease, suffering, is a craving, a habituation to what? To a view of reality that is wrong. It's a misperception. It said it's a craving that has at least three aspects to it. One could go on forever, but in short, what kind of craving is it that maintains dissatisfaction? Regarding the paradoxical flux of everything that we experience as if it were permanent. So all the meditations on transience in the Buddhist traditions are seen as antidotes to help cut through the disease of obsessional preoccupation with trying to turn aspects of our experience into something that will be permanent. That's one aspect. Another aspect that feeds and maintains this obsessional preoccupation and sustains dissatisfaction is that something is unique as opposed to forever happening infinitely in many different realms. And so there are meditations on the multiplicity and interpenetration and improbable, limitless patterns that underlie all of our experiences, that all human beings, whatever we may be suffering, we're not special in our suffering, we're not special in our insights. Parenthetically, this is deeply wounding to narcissistic personalities, yeah? So there are meditations on multiplicity to cut through uniqueness or singularity. And the reason, again, is to cut through this clinging to a wrong view of reality. And the third is thinking that there are realms of being that are self-produced or are autonomous, not contingent. And for this, the teachings perhaps best known of interdependence, that for every mode of living experience, one can always find that it occurs in context of other living beings. Not that we want it to be so, but it is the case. And so against the crippling activity of regarding or wishing that there was a special realm that was autonomous and not contingent with other living things, there are practices of interdependence, the presence of other. All of these in a nutshell are said to be not realizing the way things are, is said to be fostering disease. So that's number two. Number one is there's a cause of disease. Number two is there's a cause. wrong view, and there are practices to cut at that. Number three is that when one learns to turn one's awareness away from this addictive quality or to cut through it, that whole pattern of disease completely relaxes. It's annihilated, it's gone to peace. This is the famous nirvana. It's not like everything blows up. It's the pattern of disease, this anxiety and paranoia, relaxes. This is said to be the goal. This is the famous goal. And this nirvana or relaxation due to cutting through wrong ways of understanding the miracle of being alive, this is the goal. This is equivalent to the enlightenment, so-called, or the awakening of the Buddha. And his claim is, and his first message is, it is possible. The gospel, the good news, according to Buddhism, to make a comparative point, is that there is no pattern of suffering that can't, under appropriate circumstances of kindness, dissolve. There is no pattern of suffering. There is no kind of dukkha that can't, under appropriate circumstances of kindness, dissolve. Oh, easy to say. You know? How do you do it? That's the last. There is a way. The fourth, so again, to recapitulate, the first statement that the Buddha shared at Sarnath was a predominant feature of all living beings is disease, anxiety. We're kind of thrown. Heidegger uses this fancy term, thrownness, Geworfenheit. We don't remember. We're thrown into a world seemingly not of our own making. We don't know what to do with it. The anxiety is displaced, but it's there. You can tell in our actions. Temporarily, we're not kind to ourselves, and temporarily, we're not kind to others. Yeah? That temporary could be our whole lifetime. That's dukkha. The cause of that we've talked about is number two. Number three, this outrageous claim, just a claim, that those patterns can relax, they can dissolve. And number four, there's a way to dissolve. Or, better put, there are many ways to dissolve. And it's said that there's no sacred language and there's no special way. That's what the Buddha said. In Tibetan, Gangla Gangdul, to each temperament and capacity according to its ability to be educated. That reality itself is so accommodating. The message is so ever-present. The white light can come in a multiplicity of colors. There is no kind of person, no matter what their sect is, their caste, their gender, their language, their social status, there, for each kind of individual, there is always a way to connect to these truths. That's it. So that was the message. All the rest is, that's it. Nothing in Buddhism that you ever hear about, I always tell my students, anything you hear about, if you can't connect it to these four insights, then you go back and study. Yeah? So that is an overview of the entire kind of my idiosyncratic presentation of what goes by the name Buddhism. But the Buddhists call their tradition Sadharma. And they say then, well, so what makes a Buddhist? You know, so what makes a saint? What's the difference between a Buddhist and a non-Buddhist? They say, well, Buddhist is one who is, they feel that somehow this talk might be meaningful. And they try to say, well, it's not a religion. And they really talk against the formal structures of the time. But it's an inward process. It seems to me very much akin to what we read about in Sufi traditions, a kind of hidden inner, which is not to say that in time Buddhism became religious and ossified like many of the other traditions. But it's said that what makes, as a movement of the heart, one a Buddhist is taking solace, refuge, and shelter in three objects of focus. The first is taking refuge, shelter, and solace in there being a source, a continuing source from which surcease of sorrow may emanate. And the name for that is called Buddha. It's not Mr. Buddha or that guy or historical figure. It is that there is an awakened state. There is a possibility. Called Buddha, means source of overcoming all forms of suffering and unkindness. And that one can take solace from reflecting on that possibility. There's no dogma here. It's just a movement of the heart. The second is taking solace or refuge in the messages that emanate from that source. So the first is refuge in there being a source of moving beyond suffering. The second is taking refuge in the teachings, the messages that come from that source, and the name for that is called Dharma. Dharma. Ultimately, it said, what is the ultimate refuge of Dharma? Dharmata, reality itself. Reality itself, just as it is. And thirdly, it said that if one moves into shelter and solace by reflecting that no matter how it seems, no matter how lonely or alienated we may feel, there is always a community or a communion of worldly and saintly individuals or energies that we may attune to in community, earthly or heavenly, and take solace from. And this Sanskrit word sangha, it just means a gathering of like-minded forces. And they talk about exoteric and esoteric. It's not simply people. Sangha, in the inner sense, is the movement of the yogic energies within the mystical body of our own being when they are coherent energies. So sangha, in the most innermost sense, according to these traditions, is taking solace in being able to move into coherent patterns that resonate with the ground of being or the source that moves us beyond suffering. So this is called going to refuge. Some oppositions between what is this energy of reality or Buddha or enlightenment, or you can say in the legal sense, mutatis mutandis, but yeah, according to the changes, there's the whole battle. Call it God, not call it God. I'm not trying to make an easy ecumenism here for interfaith purposes. But what is the ultimate for which saints are messengers or carriers like an angel? Or the embodied presence of, not pointers to, not a sign to, but the very place itself. I think it's important to say something about how that is. So the first thing that's said is that this is a realm in which space is no longer crowded. The term sukha is used. Sukha, ka, the same, space, space energy. It goes well. Su is related to the Greek EU, like euphonious. It goes well. So it's sukha. Now you might say sometimes sukha, sometimes dukkha. What the Buddha said in talking about this state of enlightenment is that it is sukha. He said, but not worldly sukha. Sometimes we're happy. A common term for sukha is bliss or well-being, counterposed to suffering. He said the sukha of nirvana, the well-being of nirvana, is not what we ordinarily call happy as opposed to sad. He said it is sukha that is beyond the distinction sukha and dukkha. It is how space goes when there is no longer arising in the stream of one's life the distinctions. This is pleasant, this is unpleasant. He said that's the sukha, and therefore we call it the magnificent maha sukha. So the magnificent well-being is that energy which flows through or breaks through distinctions between pleasant and unpleasant. So sukha and dukkha. It is also said to be a realm in which death, mrtya, is not. Only things that are born die. Everything that is born dies. All things that come together go apart. But this realm that we're talking about, that saints embody, is not that kind of realm. It is a realm where death does not operate. And this is a realm that is said to be without death, beyond death. Amrtya. Amrita, cognate to the Greek word ambrosia, it is the deathless state. It is the drink of immortality. It is the mead. It is the flow that never ends nor begins. This is the characterization of the state that saints embody. And it's said that this is a realm which is not measurable, amit, abba, not father, it's not the immeasurable father. This is the realm of immeasurable light, amitabha, amitabha. I translate it as boundless radiance. Boundless radiance. It is also said to be a realm of boundless life, amitayus, life everlasting. These are words which are used to characterize the energy or the state. So we have bound, mortal on one side, and in this context, we have the unbound, the deathless state. Here are some other oppositions. This realm is said to be perfect as opposed to imperfect, free of any defect as opposed to flawed, radiant as opposed to dark, flowing as opposed to blocked, calm as opposed to upset, generous or surplus, the energy that goes beyond any boundedness, as opposed to stingy, energetic as opposed to tired, humorous as opposed to serious, completely unveiled, naked as opposed to veiled, wise as opposed to knowledgeable, timeless as opposed to timely, spontaneous as opposed to effortful, effort of good or bad, it's beyond that, paradoxical as opposed to logical, intangible as opposed to tangible. Now, if that's what God, if the word, if the utterance God can name that, no problem. If that's, then we have a basis, yeah? Ishvara. If this, in overview, is the way reality always is, boundless, effervescent, radiant, what is the nature of a seeming human that is a conduit or an embodied incarnational presence of such energy? And what is the hyphen, the connecting part of that? I will conclude here by suggesting that to the extent that the living presence in human encounter with those who are called saints in the Buddhist tradition resembles the characteristics I've just indicated, this is saintliness. To the extent they do not, or human beings do not, they are not saintly or not yet saintly. So all the characteristics of the enlightened state that I've mentioned, and there are many, are said to concretely manifest in the actual intimate human encounters. That is the ground by which the traditions for which this is normative judge. And it's said then that there's a deep mystery here which is not solvable. How is the seeming tangible presence of other living beings sometimes felt to be the living, tangible presence of the intangible? And I will reserve for my next presentation exactly how that dynamic of the intangible, almost hidden in secret, tends toward manifestation continually and effortlessly. And in that talk, I will talk about the varieties of incarnating the intangible and ways for those who are not saints to connect with saints, and the different styles of those who embody it. So I think maybe this is already enough. So thank you.